俄乌战争超过两年之后，有专家警告中国有可能会成为这场战争的最大赢家，因为中国、俄罗斯、伊朗新轴心的出现令习近平有机可乘，加上中东冲突越演越烈，伊朗、俄罗斯和东北亚的核武阴影也挥之不去。斯坦福大学胡佛研究所知名的军史专家 Victor Davis Hanson 在他的新书《万物终结》一书当中，以四个在历史上导致毁灭性灾难的经典战例给当今的领导人们敲响警钟，并对独裁者可能使用核武器引爆第三次世界大战感到担忧。汉森博士在我们和他的访谈中，除了分析俄乌战争、中东冲突和台海局势的决胜关键，也对东西方的战略思想进行了深入的比较。那么究竟当西方的杀戮文化对上东方的孙子兵法，是谁更略胜一筹呢？一起来看本期纵深视角与汉森博士的专访。Dr. Hanson, thank you so much for joining us on our VOA TV program.
Thank you.
You have written nearly 20 books on wars and history.
Yes.
What is your secret to being a productive author, as well as keep clear-headed in this chaotic world?
Well, there's only so many hours in the day, so it's always a zero-sum game. So if you're writing, it takes 2,000 or 3,000 hours per book. So I didn't really have a social life, and it was both a blessing and a curse to live on an isolated farm, so I had no distractions. So I never really went out to dinner, or I wasn't in a big city. And when I work at the Hoover Institution, I commute. And so I've never lived in a metropolitan area. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard for me to go out to dinner every night. I live out in the country. So it gave me time, so to speak, although there's a lot to do on a farm. If I had it to do over again, I think I've written 27 books. I don't know if I'd do it again because of my children. You know, I didn't spend adequate time. But that's something an old man thinks of when they look back 70 years.
Let's talk about your latest book.
Yes.
The End of Everything includes 4 case studies in war history, from the fall of Thebes to the annihilation of the Aztec Empire in 1521. But when I read through the book, like every page seems like a timely wake-up call with the war in Ukraine, the tensions across the Taiwan Strait and the Middle East. What can we learn from the past in this book?
It turns out that it's very rare when a war descends into annihilation. Usually there's an armistice or a non-conditional surrender, say World War II, World War I, Civil War. But every once in a while, a society is obliterated, its language is lost, its culture is destroyed, its physical space is ended. And that happened with classical Thebes, Carthage, Constantinople. Its infrastructure was inherited, but it was not any longer Christian, Byzantine, Western. And then Tenochtitlan, the capital, and indeed the entire empire. So what happened? Usually there's a pattern there, and these are formerly formidable powers, and they don't quite adjudicate that they're in a period of decline. Mm-hmm. Number two, they don't quite understand the nature of their enemy, that their enemy is ascendant, whether it's the Roman Republic or Alexander the Great or the Ottomans or Hernan Cortez. They have a naive view that their fortifications or their defenses, and usually it's their vast group empires have collapsed to a single entity, a city, but they have overconfidence. Their walls have never been breached almost, so they think it can't happen. They believe there's always allies over the horizon. They don't understand the nature of the commanders that are rare in history, so they don't understand what an Alexander the Great is capable of, or a Scipio Aemilianus, or a Mehmet II, or especially a Hernan Cortez, that these are authentic, ruthless military geniuses. Mm-hmm. And so there's a degree of naivete that they just don't think it can happen. Mm-hmm. And so you can see that today, that pattern, that if Vladimir Putin threatens Ukraine with nuclear war, or a Chinese general will say that he will use nuclear weapons against Japan, everybody says that's impossible, it can't happen. But they don't ask themselves, put your mind in his mind, and what is he thinking about, and do you have the defenses to thwart that should that threat be reified. So there's a naivete that can't happen. We say today, no one's used a nuclear weapon. Why would they do it? Mm-hmm. I've heard that so much about Ukraine. So what? Every month somebody threatens a nuclear weapon, but what use would it be? It doesn't matter what the use would be. The irrational can dominate in warfare. Mm-hmm. It didn't make any sense to destroy Carthage. They had lost everything in two prior Punic Wars. Why did Scipio Aemilianus level it to the ground and enslave the survivors, kill over 400,000 people? Mm-hmm. Sort of like that line in Clint Eastwood in the movie Dirty Harry, because he liked it. He wanted to.
Let's talk about the Ukraine war. With this war in Ukraine becoming a protracted one,
Yes. There's
a viewpoint in the United States suggesting that Ukraine has already lost the war, and the biggest winner is China. Yeah. What are your thoughts on this perspective?
Well, Ukraine has 1/30th of the territory of Russia. It has 1/10th of the GDP. It has less than 1/3 of the population. Mm-hmm. So if it finds itself in a protracted Somme or Verdun, it cannot win. And winning can be defined a lot of ways. If it defines the war as recovering the Donbass and the Crimea, mm-hmm. which was taken from it in 2014, but which was never the policy of the Obama administration, the Trump administration, or the Biden administration to get that back. They accepted that. Mm-hmm. But if they think they're going to defeat this juggernaut, and everybody knows the history of the Russian army, knows that they're incompetent, they're poorly led, they flounder, they look like they're going to lose, and they eventually win, mm-hmm. especially near or on their borders. And so if victory is defined by we, the Ukrainians, are going to get all the European American support, and we're going to get back the Donbass and the Crimea and push them back before 2000. It's not going to happen. If it's defined as we can stop them from making further inroads, we can negotiate over the future of the Donbass and Crimea, and probably we won't get them back, but we will get Russia back to the 2022 border. And maybe we will not be in NATO, but we will be heavily armed and deter them from ever, then that's possible. And that's a pathway. But China likes this because there's a new axis that's opportunistic. Russia, Iran, China, yes. North Korea. They've peeled off American allies like Turkey, Qatar, that have a quasi-relationship with this axis. Mm-hmm. And more important, Chinese Machiavellian thinking is that they've always had a historical rivalry with Russia. So they like nothing better than Russia is being weakened and the United States is being exhausted as far as its supplies to supply Taiwan. And we're supplying Israel and Ukraine. We have no 150-millimeter shells. We're backlogged 8 years with Javelin missiles. We're backlogged with Patriot missiles. And China sees this. And if Russia were to win, and that is take over Ukraine, mm-hmm. then they would see that they look how the world reacted, and they would think that the unthinkable could be possible with Taiwan.
Mm. A recent report from a British think tank raised concerns of China's learning Russia's war in Ukraine, and is preparing a protracted war in the Indo-Pacific region as well, potentially involving the Taiwan Strait and South China Sea, plus the conflict in the Middle East. We look at all the conflicts and the powers behind them. You just mentioned the new Axis powers. It's very similar to the one in World War II. Do you worry about the World War III?
I do. You could make the argument that by 1940, before Japan attacked us, the greater Asia co-prosperity sphere was a mercantile system set up by Japan. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of the model for China. In other words, China goes to South Korea, to Japan, to Australia, to the Philippines, and says, we are Asian people, or we're in the same, even in Australia, we're in the same hemisphere. The United States is a setting power. It's not going to come to your defense. It says the same thing to Taiwan. So why don't you make a deal on our terms, and we will protect you under new protectorate. This is exactly what Japan did. And it's an exploitive relationship. And they think, if you think the United States is going to come to your rescue, look what it does to its Afghan allies or its Iraq. So that's the argument that China is using right now. And it's been persuasive, I think. The question is, China is looking at the Ukraine border, and it's trying to extrapolate if that's applicable to crossing the South China Sea, because that's a different 90 miles that could be mined, like submarines, and they would have to have air, not superiority, but air supremacy. That would be very hard to achieve against the combined air forces of South Korea, Japan, and the United States. So I don't think it yet thinks it can invade Taiwan. I think more likely it feels it could blockade it or coerce it, turn it into something like 1940s Finland or Finland during the Cold War, just an impotent neutral that would have no ties, and then slowly let it die on the vine. But I think a cross-channel invasion, they see the losses that Russia has lost 300,000 dead. Mm-hmm. When China has a one-child policy, maybe they would feel that even though they have a much larger population than Russia, that they could not afford to have families lose their only child. They would lose a lot of people trying to take Taiwan. Mm. And it would depend on also who comes to Taiwan's aid. They're looking at that very carefully. Who came to Ukraine's aid? They're looking at drones. They're looking at all these modalities, and they're trying to figure out in a cost-to-benefit analysis, if we were to do that, what would be the reaction of the world on trade, on oil, on the sea lanes? And I think they're starting to conclude that the world sort of shrugs about Israel has to do what it has to do, Ukraine has to do, Russia. But the world's not going to come together and try to stop a war. And they think that's probably a good idea if they ever wanted to do it.
But Dr. Hinson, if we look at the lessons from history for all those leaders, military blunders and overreaching ambitions in history often have led to catastrophic consequences, just like Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy, and the Japanese Empire. Do you think Putin and Xi Jinping also risk facing a similar fate if they persist with military aggressive campaigns?
It's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Most wars start because there's a group of possible belligerents, and the cast of characters has not made it clear what their relative power is. And therefore, an aggressor makes a mistake because they interpret a reluctance to go to war with an inability to go to war. So to take your example, in 1939 to 41, because of Soviet collaboration with Germany under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and because of American isolation, and because of British and French appeasement, Italy and Germany and later Japan came to the conclusion that these people would not fight. What they didn't understand was that if they pushed them far enough and invaded their territory, they would fight. And when you looked at the British, not Britain, but the British Empire and the Soviet Union, and the United States, and you looked at their industrial capacity, their population, their territory, in every category of aviation fuel, steel production, aluminum production, manpower, there was no way that the Axis could win that war. If you extrapolate that, China is looking at Afghanistan, yes. It put a balloon across the United States. It has a bio lab in the San Joaquin Valley. It does all kinds of aggressive things. It sends fentanyl to Mexico, 100,000 dead. And Russia has been very provocative. So is Iran, as you see with Hezbollah. And so far, they have not got a concentrated Western response. And that has endangered it because they don't know, or they mislead themselves of the real power of the Europeans, the United States, and their Asian allies. If you took a disinterested view and you put down on paper, this is the Army and the Air Force of Japan. This is the Army and the Air Force of Australia. This is the Army and the Air Force of Taiwan. This is the Army and the Air Force of South Korea. This is the Army and the Air Force of 25 NATO powers. This is the Army, the Air Force, the Navy of the United States. This is the manpower. And these are other allies such as India or South. Then, and you look at GDP, they would be crazy to start a war, because they do not have the wherewithal. They have a large population, but they do not have, between the United States and its NATO powers, they have over 8,000 deliverable nuclear weapons. They have a very sophisticated anti-missile system. They have 90% of the carriers on the force. They have very sophisticated weapons. The margin is getting closer to China, but China is not at a point, and we keep talking about its GDP, mm-hmm. its economy. It's still about two-thirds of ours. So that means that although it has almost four times the population, mm-hmm. it means one American worker is producing more goods and services by 30% than our four Chinese counterparts. We don't think about that, and they do. So they're at a point where they're trying to correlate the unwillingness to prepare or the unwillingness to arm or the unwillingness to defend their interest mm-hmm. with the potential to do that. And they don't know if they were to overreach, as you say, the potential might be reified, and then they would be in trouble. And that happened in World War I by November 1941 to November 1942. The Axis realized that after a year of easy victories, the United States economy kicked in, the Russian economy kicked in, the British Empire kicked in. And then after November 1942, there was no way they were going to win that war. So I think they're students of history. But it's very important that the West and its allies make it clear to China that it not only has the ability to counteract its aggression, but it has the willingness to do so.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hansen, in the end of everything, you mentioned several times there have been a threat from Russia to use nuclear weapon against Ukraine. And China, you just mentioned about
yes.
that Chinese general also threat to use nuclear weapon to Taiwan.
Yes.
Iran towards Israel, and of course North Korea towards South Korea, Japan and United States. We all remember how World War II ended.
Yeah.
But now we have mutual assured destruction, the yes. MAD. So how close are we to the nuclear war breaking out in our today's geopolitical landscape, in your opinion?
Well, they're very sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. The fact that I put that one phrase into the end of everything that said that China has threatened Taiwan, the Chinese publisher wrote me the other day and said mm-hmm. that they would not issue that book in Chinese unless I remove that. Mm-hmm. Now, they didn't say it. They just said, and I wouldn't do it, so there will be no Chinese edition. Mm-hmm. So you can see they're very, very sensitive. But whether these threats become actual acts of aggression depends on deterrence. And deterrence is not just the ability to defeat an enemy that challenges, but the perception.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that we have not had a nuclear weapon used since World War II is that during the Cold War and the aftermath, there was the perception that NATO and the United States or Israel would use nuclear weapons if they were attacked. And that sent a message to China mm-hmm. and to Russia. The same was true with India and Pakistan. That Pakistan knew that if it provoked India, it would be obliterated. And mm-hmm. But the problem now is we have the nuclear family is growing. We stopped South Africa, we stopped Ukraine, but it's pretty clear that Iran is going to get a bomb. And Iran is going to feign that it doesn't adhere to deterrence. So it's very, very important for Western powers to make it very, very clear that any threat that's actualized will result in the destruction of the aggressor and make that clear. But if you don't do that, and this is why I sounded this word of alarm, mm-hmm. if you get out of Afghanistan and you flee and you leave $50 billion of equipment, $1 billion brand new embassy, a $400 million refitted airbase. You let a Chinese balloon traverse the whole United States, they will get the wrong impression that the United States either won't or can't mm-hmm. deter China, and they will do something stupid. And that something stupid could be at a juncture using nuclear weapons. So if they decide to go across the South China Sea
mm-hmm.
and they suffer unexpected losses, and a Chinese general gets an okay from Mr. Qi and says, we're going to use a nuclear weapon, they have to know that if they were to do that, it would not be in their interest. And for now, for the next 10 to 12, 15 years, they will not have nuclear parity with the West. After that, probably they will.
The title of your new book, The End of Everything,
yes,
reminds me of another book, The End of History,
yes,
you know, by Francis Fukuyama. Professor Fukuyama argued that the forces of democracy and capitalism would eventually prevail, leading to the end of ideological conflict, which marks the end of history. But your book suggests that all the collective naivete you just mentioned, folly, rage, violence, new military technologies, as well as totalitarian ideologies, might lead to the end of everything. What insight does your book hope to provide to the readers?
Well, I'd like to remind people that human nature is constant, and that technology, modern fads and culture, that's just a veneer. It's like having a more efficient pump that pumps water at a much greater volume, but the water itself doesn't change. And I think when people say the end of history, that we're going to all accept a new democratic mentality that we haven't in the past. In fact, since that book has been published, there's fewer democracies than when it was published, and that book predicted there would be more. So I think it's always a yin and a yang. It's cyclical. And we're seeing a lot of rejection of democracy as we speak. And so I think human nature is constant, and the only thing we know about human nature being constant is there's certain rules that it can be checked. And when people become aggressive and illiberal and they're not in democracies, then you have to deter them, and we know how to deter them. And then the other thing is, there's nothing in history that suggests that democracies are necessarily less likely to go to war. So Athens goes to war with democratic Syracuse, the biggest democracy in the Greek world. The Venetians fought almost everybody. They had a Venetian Republic. They fought other Italian republics. Nobody said we're both consensual societies, we shouldn't fight. Civil War, there was a consensual society. I mean, the Confederates actually had a legislative pattern after the North, and a chief. They still fought. So there's a greater propensity not to go to war when too democratic, but the idea that we're all going to be democracies and then therefore we have nothing in common, it's not quite true. There's a lot of examples throughout history that consensual societies can fight each other.
I want to talk about another book. In another book, Carnage and Culture, yes, I liked it very much. You analyze the factors of all the victories of Western armies, which has received wide attention in China. I don't know if you know that.
I didn't know quite that extent, no.
How do you compare the Western carnage and culture to the Chinese art of wars by Sun Tzu? Using more secret strategies,
yes,
strategic deception, like spies, or long-term planning, or enduring patience, like playing long game on chessboard. Many people in China ask, who has the edge, East or West?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, it's a whole menu. The Western way of war is not just decisive battle versus subterfuge or indirect war, because there's been a lot of Chinese generals who believed in catastrophic collisions of armies. There's been a lot of Western generals, Sherman and Patton, who believed in an indirect approach. But there is a greater tendency in the West that democracies or constitutional societies want to marshal their forces and sustain a quick victory, overwhelmingly defeat, humiliate the enemy, and go home. And they don't look at a long-term to the same degree that less liberal societies in China. If you look at, for example, you mentioned the Sun Tzu. Right about the time that he wrote The Art of War, there was a comparable military treatise written from a Western perspective, Aeneas Tacticus, titled in Greek, On the Defense of Fortified Positions. And they both talk about how to attack cities. And the Western approach is, there is a city, there's only three ways to do it. You go over, you go through, or you go under. And it's not embedded with philosophy or anything else. It's just dum, dum, dum. You read Sun Tzu.
It's different.
When he talks, it's the yin and mm-hmm. the yang and the hot and the cold. And it's part of a larger philosophical system mm-hmm. that suggests that you really don't want to go under, through, or over, but you want to convince people that you're not doing it, or perception, and it's based on the idea that you're not going to have a mass consensus and organize the population and just do it and then quit. But there's also, just very quickly, a larger menu in the Western way, where it's not just decisive battle, it has a greater propensity to have market capitalism. It's a greater propensity to have a rational rather than irrational point. It's a greater propensity for drill and a particular type of order where you define personal courage not as berserking or heroism, but solidarity, staying in formation. Mm-hmm. It's a greater reliance on technology. And you can see, as a result of rationalism, mm-hmm. and you can see what the Chinese have done. There's no iron law that says when you see a Chinese army on parade, it looks like a Western army, not mm-hmm. vice versa. It has rejected its indigenous traditions of how people look in war, what type of weapons. China invented gunpowder, but mostly as a celebratory firework. When the West stole it, immediately they said, what's the practical use? And then they put it out into the world of market capitalism, and each person was competing. And subsequently, every single invention in gunpowder did not come from the inventors. Corn powder, flintlocks, percussion caps, etc., black powder, mm-hmm. smokeless, it all came from the West as a result of people wanting to have a better product to get a better market share. Mm-hmm. And China has now understood that. So for all of its talk about Sun Tzu and its own military tradition, as we speak, it probably has 3,500 people in the United States who are actively looking for military technology mm-hmm. to bring back to China. Every major weapon system in China has come from a Western weapon that they've tried to improve on Western ideas of improvement and mm-hmm. competition. And so whatever they say, they are about as Western as the Japanese. Japanese were the same way. After the westernization of Japan in the late 19th century, they sent 350,000 students to Germany to learn artillery and rifle tactics, mortars. And then suddenly Germany lost World War I, they took them out and sent them to Britain to learn naval technology. And they ended up making battleships and aircraft carriers and some mortars that were better than the creators. But they were Western Japan.
So many people now in Naval Academy study Sun Tzu. And then just like the people in China study your book to understand why Western army always win. In the modern world, modern war, when Western military culture meets Eastern military ideas, which one has the advantages to have the better chance to win, in your opinion? Because you understand both,
yes.
Right?
Well, I mean, the Western paradigm never ensures automatic Western victory. Mm-hmm. But what it does is, at least from antiquity, and it goes... There's peaks and valleys, there's the Ottomans, but what it does, it gives advantages to overcome disadvantages. So what do I mean by that? If you took indigenous warfare, the Aztec Maya War, they had no ability to sail into Barcelona and take the Spanish Empire. But how could just 1,500 people sail 5,000 miles across the Pacific mm-hmm. and then invade Mexico with an empire of 4 million? Without superior weapons and cavalry and Toledo steel and the beginning of the tercio military formation and a whole codified idea of command and chain of command. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Spanish brought to that. And so what I'm getting at is when Western armies are overextended and they're in places they shouldn't be, like Custer and Little Bighorn, they can lose, obviously, because mm-hmm. geography, weather, manpower, relative size of armies, that all plays a role. But what it does is it gives Western armies a greater advantage mm-hmm. to do what non-Western armies do, depending on how much they adopt this pattern of market capitalism, rationalism, as I said, definition of courage is not individual bravery necessarily, but group formation and solidarity, and then high technology. And so I don't know any army today. People have said that asymmetrical warfare, say in Gaza that we're watching, or during Fallujah, during the Iraq War, this was a non-Western. But the point was that the people who were fighting Western armies, like Hamas, they were all using Western weapons. They were all using Western type of uniforms, chain of command. They were using, and they were advantageous. They were saying the West has to come into our situation. Nobody in Hamas said, we're going to have a conventional tank attack and go in as they tried in the Yom Kippur War. They couldn't do it. And so if it's bin Laden or anybody, it has to be asymmetrical. And even when it's asymmetrical, they have to use Western appurtenances and technology. Mm-hmm. And so I think most people concede that if you're going to win a major war, you have to go Western. And I think the United States has understood anytime it wanted to, anytime Israel today wants to destroy Gaza, it has it in its power to destroy Gaza, root and branch. So does the United States in places in Iraq or Africa. It could have, but it had self-restraints because of a consensual society that oversees the use of, you know, war and morality and human rights. It won't use the full extent of its power. But the other sides don't have that ability. If you said to Gaza tomorrow, all of mm-hmm. Hamas, you have 100,000 people, you have 7,000 mm-hmm. rockets, go destroy Israel. They could not do it.
You have another book called A War Like No Other, which focuses on the Peloponnesian War, a conflict that echoed the struggle between two superpowers battling to the death. How does this pattern of hegemonic transition apply to the rivalry between U.S. and China? Can we avoid that classic Thucydides trap, in your opinion?
That was a popular thesis put forth by Graham Allison at Harvard, mm-hmm. and he called it Thucydides trap. And that came from a particular line mm-hmm. in Thucydides, at which time when he was trying to explain the cause of the war. Mm-hmm. Why did Sparta preempt and start the war? And he said it was the fear of Athenian power and its growth. And the implication was that Athens was an ascendant power, and because it was naval, cosmopolitan, Ionian, a seaport with a huge navy, that inevitably it would be a more dynamic society. Mm-hmm. So the traditional power, Sparta, the land power, thought that if it did not preempt at this point, then it would lose any future war. So in 431, it invaded Attica. So Graham Allison took that one line, mm-hmm. and said that in all cases that there's ascendant powers, i.e. China, mm-hmm. then the stationary or traditional hegemon, out of fear, strikes out, sometimes irrationally, and that can cause a war. Mm-hmm. So they must manage the relationship with an ascendant power. There were some problems with it. If you look at the entire text of Thucydides, mm-hmm. there were various reasons why they went to war that were ancillary or supplementary to that one fear. Mm-hmm. For example, at the end of Book 1, the Corinthians and the Spartans talk about the Athenians. Mm-hmm. Or in Funeral Oration of Pericles, he talks about Athens versus Sparta. And what he says, and you aggregate all of these other speeches, which are much greater in number than this one analysis. Sparta is a land power. Athens is a sea power. Athens opens its city to the world. It has people all over. It's cosmopolitan. It's democratic. These people are oligarchic, mm-hmm. and they're closed-minded. They're Dorians. We're Ionian liberal. So there's so many fault lines of difference that they had been fighting at a point when they were equal, when one side was ahead of the other, and after the war is over, there is a lot of imbalances where not necessarily an ascendant power is attacked by a traditional power, but there's other fault lines, and those fault lines can be ethnic, religious, political, social, cultural. Mm-hmm. I think you can make the argument that the reason that those two societies fought as they had for 50 years in a Cold War, and as they would again, it was because they didn't manage their differences. They understood they were very, very different people. But they had people at both sides who were atypical. If you had Pericles and if you had Archidamus, these were sober and responsible leaders who understood that if they did fight, it would be a limited war and you did not want to take risk. If you look at the generation that followed them, Alcibiades, or people like Gylippus, or Brasidas, or Lysander, these were reckless, imaginative, brilliant people, and so they escalated what could have been a contained war.
Back to the human nature as well.
Yes.
So the political leader, the policymaker, really should learn from the lessons from those stories.
Yes.
So they can avoid.
Yes, I think everybody has to understand that when you take, just to take example that you brought up of Ukraine, we say Vladimir Putin is crazy. I think our president's called him a killer. He would never do nuclear weapons. But if you look at history, the more wise point is, you imagine that you are Vladimir Putin, and you say that Ukraine was part of the Soviet Empire all during its inceptions from 1918. In the case of Ukraine, it goes back centuries. And you say that what would be the situation if we have a sphere of influence in the United States or the Caribbean and a foreign power tried to break away or have a former possession ally itself with a rival. For example, in 1962 or 1959, we had a revolution in Cuba. That was considered an American protectorate. We freed it from Spain. It was pretty corrupt. We had the mafia there, but Cuba was considered synonymous with 90 miles away in Florida. We have a Marxist revolution. The Soviet Union supplies Mr. Castro. 3 years later, they put nuclear weapons there. It's perfectly, that's a sovereign country. It's perfectly willing. John F. Kennedy says, well, this is the Monroe Doctrine. You have no right to do that. And the Soviets thought, yes, we do. And we almost went to a nuclear war until they realized that this was a sphere of American influence. And they would act irrationally toward any incursion in that they felt. So taking that paradigm, we say we're right on the border of Russia. And this is a historical part of Russia. And while the moral right is with Ukraine, we have to manage this in such a way that we don't force Russia into humiliation. And yes, he's evil. Yes, they were the aggressor. But we have to find a solution short of a war, because I don't think it's going to be easy for either side, unless you want to have a five-year Verdun. They have to have an exit strategy. And so the exit strategy, looking at history, you would tell Mr. Putin, yes, you went to war to institutionalize Crimea and Donbass. You had taken them, but people had said they would take them back from you. No, they're not going to be able. So that's a victory for you. And you went to war to show everybody that Ukraine would not be in NATO. You got that. But you also lost 350,000 dead, probably. And we are going to arm Ukraine. And that's it. You go back to where you were on February of 2022. You get to have the Crimea and the Donbass. We won't be in NATO, but we are going to arm Ukraine to such a degree that if you ever try that, you're going to regret it. And that's the basis of a settlement that would stop the not reward Putin. And we got to remember, as I said, when he went into the Donbass and Crimea, Mr. Obama said, oh my gosh, he went in there. We're going to get back Crimea. He can't take, he didn't say that. And when Trump came in for all of his tough talk, he didn't say, we're going to take back. He did. And when Biden came in, he actually cut aid to Ukraine. He froze 100 million. We don't want to antagonize him. And all of a sudden now it's, we got to get back Crimea. But no administration had previously said that. That, so you have to imagine, if you're going to have a settlement, even the evil people, what, how they're going to react. Doesn't mean you're going to excuse their aggression. And sometimes you have to be realistic. If Vladimir Putin did not have 6,000 nuclear weapons, then that would be a different case. It would be something like Hitler or Tojo or Mussolini in World War II. But the idea that you're going to take back Donbass and Crimea, and then you're going to go in, and to do that, military strategy dictates that you'd have to hit supply dumps, oil platforms inside Russia. You'd have to destroy the Black Sea Fleet. And the idea that a nuclear power would allow that to happen, I don't think is realistic.
Do you think it would be a catastrophic one if they fight over Taiwan?
Yes, I think this, what China wants to know, mm-hmm. and what the world wants to know, and what Taiwan until recently has not demonstrated, if China were to attack Taiwan, mm-hmm. would because of the Chinese kindred ties, and because Taiwan, of all the major rivals, is the smallest, would the Taiwanese put up a fight comparable to what South Korea would, or Japan would, or Australia would, or what the United States would come to their aid? Mm-hmm. And previously, when you looked at Taiwanese readiness in terms of technology, arms, and willingness to fight, I think China felt that it was not as militarily prepared as mm-hmm. South Korea or Australia. And I think that's changing now. So what's happening is there's a window of opportunity that China is looking at. And they're saying, will we ever get an administration like the Biden administration that has let people walk all over them? Will we ever get an administration that allows us to send balloons over the United States? Will we ever get an administration to put a bio lab in Reedley, California, where I live, mm-hmm. where it has deadly viruses? And will you ever get an administration that won't do anything about it? What would we do if on the border of Tibet, they sent in drugs to kill 100, like the opium like they used to, and the English. What would we do? So they're looking at this, and they're baffled. They're saying, if we were the United States, and we did to us what we're doing to the United States, we would hit them. But why are they not doing this? And so that encourages them. And then they say, does Taiwan... is it going to be weaker next week or stronger? And they think, you know what? They are starting to get wise to us. And they are thinking of making it very, very costly. And they are trying to solve the problem between Japan and South Korea. And they have Australia coming in. And if Trump comes in, he's very unpredictable. We have no idea what he'd do. He's crazy. He could do anything. That's deterrence. So it is a very dangerous time from now until the election, and then when they look at Russia again, they're looking at Ukraine and they're trying to see what are the lessons. And I think they're coming across that people, I don't think they think they can go overnight like taking Kiev. Mm-hmm. They think that even a protracted long war, shelling it, embargoing it, putting a blockade around Taiwan, starving it, the world would tire of that, just as they're tiring of Ukraine. And the Taiwanese would tire of it, or they would run out of manpower. And they would, if they're willing to shell it or miss it, like the 1/4 of the population of Ukraine is left. And their problem is not equipment, it's manpower. And Taiwan would be very short of people very quickly if they were bombed by the Chinese or rockets would come in there. I don't think, mm-hmm. everybody has the wrong impression. They think it's going to be D-Day coming on the beach. I don't think so. I think if they were going to take it, they would send 3 or 4 weeks of bombing and missiles attack and destroy the infrastructure and the population center. And then they would blockade the island. And then they would tell everybody, we have no problem with NATO. We do not have any problem in the United States. This is our business. You don't want to come in here. We're peaceful people. And why would you want to die? They would say, why would anybody in Nebraska want to die for Taiwan? And that's their strategy.
So you think that the election in November will be crucial for both Ukraine and Taiwan?
Yeah, you know, I think it's very important that Ukraine is not swallowed by Russia. It's very important that Russia learns a lesson that a West in its decrepitude still has the ability to arm an ally and to repel it. It's very important for us not to get carried away as we were last spring when we said we're going to go into Russia and we're going to have a spring offensive. And anybody with a right mind would say, why would you do that? Mm-hmm. They have such greater asymmetry and resources. And it's like a ram hitting its head against a cement wall. We should have said, you should build the corridor, not them. Well, you should have a tank trap. You should have a 600-mile line wall. You should mine it and tell the Russians they can't go any further because you have less resource. Let the Russians keep hitting the wall, bomb them, but don't try to be an offensive power to go into Russia almost. It's crazy. And so they're looking at all of this and they're trying to, I think they've already made some conclusions, China, that the world doesn't care, that the West is exhausted, that the Taiwanese may be rearming too late. And now they're just asking themselves, is the hit in disruption to the world economy, embargoes of our trade, would that be greater than the benefit of never having to worry about Taiwan? And then there's other people in China are saying, why would you invade it? For all their talk about being Western, they have enormous investment. We can slowly grind them down over 100 years. Why would you start to disrupt this? We're in the driver's seat. The West is getting weaker. We're getting stronger. We can have the Taiwanese appease us, and we can gradually win them over. The Taiwanese are too affluent. They're too leisured. They're Westernized. They don't want to fight. Mm-hmm. Just wait it out. So that conversation and debate is going on in China.
After discussing with you on the end of everything and all the wars in history like descended to annihilation, Ukraine war, potential of conflict between U.S. and China. Finally, I'd like to ask you what beliefs and hopes you hold regarding those challenges facing our contemporary world and the future of humanity?
Yeah. Well, I have to hope that we don't end, that there are rational people that look at history and they don't get fooled by technology, by affluence, by leisure, and to think that we've reached the end of history and we have a utopian. We tried that in the 1930s with the League of Nations. The Kellogg-Briand Act outlawed war. Mm-hmm. And when we said, there will be no aggression, we're never going to have the Great War. It wasn't called World War I. It was called the Great War because that was the end of it. They had to rename it World War I when World War II started. Mm-hmm. And Mussolini went right through the Mediterranean into East Africa, and they let him go right to the Suez. And the League of Nations, don't do that. We're going to sanction you. And when you look at that, you think, wait a minute. The British fleet and the French fleet in the Mediterranean could have blown the Italians out of the water, but they didn't. And the League of Nations kept saying, you can't do that, you can't. It's like the United Nations. Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at is we shouldn't think that we're so sophisticated, we've so transcended war, we're so refined and civilized that we would never return to our barbarian selves, because somebody will. And therefore, deterrence is the only thing that will keep the peace. So each generation, as we get more and more leisure, it's more difficult. And the people who say this are more stigmatized and considered ossified, reactionary, Neanderthals, kind of like Ronald Reagan was or Donald Trump. But it's very important in the case of the Ukrainians and the Taiwanese to think this is very possible. And the Chinese, even though it might not be in their interest as we see it, they may think it is. And they may attack us at any moment. And the only reason that they won't is to the degree to think that we will cause them more injury than benefit. And if somebody says, well, that would mean we'd have to spend 3, 5, 8, 10% of GDP on defense, and we wouldn't have video games for our kids. You say yes, and we'd be alive. So that's very hard to do. That's kind of the paradox of the West. It's so successful with the combination of constitutional government and personal freedom with free market capitalism. You create such freedom and ease and familiarity and money and leisure that it's very hard to remember how you got to where you are. And how you got to where you are was very tough thinking, sacrifice, deterrence, big budgets to deter people. If you forget that lesson and you think there's going to be an international body, the EU going to come to the help of Taiwan? Mm-hmm. Taiwan gets into trouble and they're going to say, I'm going to call up the EU on the phone. And somebody's having cappuccino in Florence. You think he's going to go die in Taiwan? No. So you have to convince people, if you're Taiwanese, that you're willing to die for the freedom of Taiwan. If you convince people and you're going to arm yourself to the teeth, then you're not going to convince somebody in Florence, but you might convince somebody in Colorado, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Hansen, for sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.